Members, we come to oral questions. Question number one in the name of Mark Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Climate Change. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
The Honourable James Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, in the context in which they were made. In particular, I stand by the decision taken in 2019 to work with the agricultural sector on a plan to reduce agricultural emissions. Since then, the He Waka e Kanoa Partnership has been engaging widely with the farming community, and the government supports this work. In fact, I also stand by the decision to grant the partnership an additional month to conduct appropriate consultation with farmers ahead of delivering their advice to ministers at the end of May. Mr. Speaker, during that time, and including this very morning, ministers have engaged regularly and constructively with the partnership leads who represent the vast majority of the New Zealand agricultural sector, including Apiculture New Zealand, Beef and Lamb, Dairy NZ, the Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand, Deer Industry New Zealand, Federated Farmers, the Federation of Māori Authorities, Fonterra, the Foundation for Arable Research, Horticulture New Zealand, Irrigation New Zealand and the Meat Industry Association. I note that Groundswell New Zealand have, to date and very recently, refused to engage with the government as part of that leadership collective. Mr. Speaker, the agricultural sector has a critical role to play
order.
In our bid to...
The members well and truly address the question.
Supplementary.
Mark Cameron.
Does he continue to stand by his position, which he affirmed in the House on the 10th of March 22, that farmers have the tools necessary to offset emissions, and if so, to what tools was he referring?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, I think that the member needs to have more faith in the farming community of New Zealand. There are farms all over the country that have introduced a variety of technological and practice changes, have reduced their emissions by more than 10% and increased their profitability at the same time. I think that he needs to look no further than research that was done by the Biological Emissions Research Group that was set up under the previous national government and a series of industry research papers and experiments done on farms all over the country.
Commercially available anyway. Does he accept that if Kiwi farmers don't have access to adequate methane mitigation technologies, they may be forced to reduce stock numbers to decrease emissions?
Well, I accept that what I've seen from the science so far, which is that there are farms all over the country that have reduced their methane emissions and increased their profitability by changing their business models. And I think what we need to focus here is on the profitability of farms, particularly for those farms that are particularly struggling with increased debt as a result of over-leveraging in the last decade.
Supplementary. Does he agree with the Honourable Damien O'Connor's response in Select Committee on the 10th of February 2022, quote, I don't think there needs to be, end quote, when he asked if we need a reduction in the national herd size?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Supplementary. Would it be fair to push farmers into an emissions pricing scheme when they don't have the tools to reduce emissions without reducing stock numbers?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think that the member needs to have more faith in the New Zealand farming community and in the agricultural businesses that are conducting research and have been conducting research over the course of the last decade. Mr. Speaker, this government has spent something like $200 million over the course of the last 10 to 12 years, started by the previous national government, continued by the current government, into reducing agricultural emissions. It's quite clear that the New Zealand agricultural sector, as I said, including Apiculture New Zealand, Beef and Lamb, Dairy NZ, the Dairy Companies Association of New Zealand, Deer Industry New Zealand, Federated Farmers, the Federation of Māori Authorities, Fonterra, the Foundation for Arable Research, Horticulture New Zealand, Irrigation New Zealand, the Meat Industry Association have got with the program, and I think that that member should too.
Supplementary.
Supplementary, Mark Cameron.
Is the Minister concerned if the methodology that is used currently in the consultation process between the ETS and the He Waka e Kanoa is not done in a fair and honest fashion, this will drive up the food prices of staples such as milk and meat?
Well, I'm sort of reserving my judgment until we receive the final recommendations of the partnership at the end of May, and we'll be conducting analysis after that.
Question number two, in the name of Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, Does he stand by his statement that the government is, quote, making sure that we do support those on low and middle incomes who are the most affected by rising prices, end quote? If so, what level of income does he consider qualifies as middle income?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Speaker, yes, I do stand by that statement. The government recognises that many New Zealanders are facing a cost of living crisis due to global factors, including the Russian invasion of Ukraine. This has particularly impacted on fuel prices, which is why the government moved swiftly to ease that pressure by cutting fuel excise duty. It's also why we're supporting New Zealanders by delivering income increases for many families, superannuitants and those on government support from tomorrow. In answer to the second part of the question, the definition of middle income does depend on each household's particular circumstances. One thing we do know is that more than half of taxpayers earn less than $48,000. What I can say in terms of a definition is that it doesn't cover those who earn over $180,000, who the member wants to give thousands of dollars of tax cuts to.
Supplementary. Well, is he aware that according to Stats New Zealand, the average household income is $110,000? And can he explain why these middle income families will not get a single dollar out of his so-called income package?
Well, Mr Speaker, Stats New Zealand numbers, depending on the day or depending on the month that are used, the HLFS ones for June 2021 have a median earning level of $56,000 and a mean earning level of $67,000. In answer to the second part of the member's question, as we have said many times in this House, our focus in the April the 1st package is on those on low and middle incomes who deserve a boost from the government denied by many years by national governments.
Supplementary. When will the minister give relief to the squeezed middle who don't qualify for government entitlements but who are slipping backwards each week as they contend with the biggest cost of living crisis in a generation?
Mr Speaker, the member may not have noticed, but several weeks ago the government removed fuel excise, or 25 cents of fuel excise duty. Well, it is, in fact, for the member, because it's delivering for those who actually fill up their tank once a week, somewhere between $10 and $15 a week, which is a great deal more than a lot of people would get from the member's tax package.
Is it the minister's position that an average household deserves no relief other than a reduction in the petrol tax he increased to begin with?
Mr Speaker, it's my position that all New Zealand households deserve a government that properly funds health, that properly funds education, that properly funds housing, and that makes sure that it gets the balance right in supporting low and middle income families. Mr Speaker, there have been no easy decisions for the government through the COVID period, but I believe we've got the balance about right.
Supplementary. Why won't he inflation adjust tax thresholds so that an average income family could look forward to a $1,600 income boost this year?
Mr Speaker, as we have covered many times in this House, the member can't have it always. It's not possible to cut taxes, cut debt and increase spending. And her leader just this week has said, yes, I want to see benefits increase. Yes, I want to see mental health spending increase. You can't have it all three of those ways.
Supplementary.
Chloe Swarbrick.
What advice has he received on rent controls, taking into account that 1 in 4 renters compared to 1 in 9 homeowners spend more than 40% of their income on housing costs?
Mr Speaker, as the Minister of Finance, I haven't received any recent advice on rent controls. I know that those questions have been put in the past to the Minister of Housing and others, and I would direct the member to them.
Supplementary.
Nicola Willis.
Is the $20 a week increase for working for families more or less than the increase in the cost of living for the average household?
Oh, Mr Speaker, that will depend on what the average household is facing. What I do know is the 60% of New Zealand families who will be getting that family tax credit increase will be very pleased to receive that kind of support and possibly interested to know that the National Party voted against it.
The Honourable Dr Megan Wood.
Can the Minister confirm that $20 a week is more than $2.15 a week that families earning $48,000 would get under the Opposition's package?
Well, Mr Speaker, yes, I...
I'm pretty sure that's not in order. Nicola Willis.
Supplementary. Well, is he aware that the $21 a week increase for working for families is less than the around $70 a week increase forecast in the cost of living for an average household on $60,000 with two children? And isn't it the case that under this government, all New Zealand families are facing a cost of living crisis that's set to get worse?
Mr Speaker, in answer to the second part of the member's question, we are aware, very well aware on this side of the House, that the factors that are driving cost of living increases, such as supply chain constraints, such as the war in Ukraine, such as the ongoing impact of COVID-19, are having an impact on households, and we as a government have an obligation to look after those who are affected the most. We also have an obligation, Mr Speaker, to invest properly in our health system, to make sure that we address the inequities in our health system, to make sure that we have proper schools, that we build housing, that we look after mental health. None of those things, Mr Speaker, would be possible if the member carries through with her tax cut policy that would favour those on the highest incomes.
We come to question number three, in the name of Rachel Brooking.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Energy and Resources. What evidence has she seen that consumers are benefiting as a result of the government's action to cut fuel excise by 25 cents a litre?
Mr
Speaker, I'm pleased to say the government's announcement to cut fuel excise by 25 cents per litre led to fuel prices across New Zealand falling. Little over an hour after the announcement, prices at the pump started falling and they continue to fall. For example, last week in Hastings, the lowest price of regular 91 was 57 cents per litre less than on the day before the cut to the fuel excise duty being announced. That's not all. In Hamilton, the lowest price of regular 91 was 53 cents lower. In Greymouth, it was 40 cents per litre lower. In Christchurch, it was 39% lower. All these figures show our reduction in excise is already making a big difference to the price consumers pay at the pump across the country.
Supplementary.
Rachel Brooking.
How will the government ensure consumers are receiving the full benefit of the cut in fuel excise?
Mr Speaker, yesterday new information disclosure regulations that will require fuel industry participants to disclose information relating to their wholesale and retail fuel margins were signed off by the Governor-General. These regulations will come into effect tomorrow, the 1st of April. The regulations will monitor whether the reduction to petrol excise duty is being passed through to consumers. People will be able to see if they're getting a fair deal on fuel at the MB website. The transparency will enable consumers to make informed choices about where they buy their fuel.
How long has the government been working on ensuring there are fairer prices at the pump?
Mr Speaker, the government passed legislation in 2020 in response to a market study we commissioned that found there was a lack of competition in the industry. This demanded more transparent pricing at the wholesale level and on forecourts so motorists can clearly see what the pricing is. The information disclosure regime coming into effect tomorrow is only possible as a result of a work programme of action by this government.
We come to question number four in the name of Dr. Shane Petty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Health, does he stand by his statements and actions around the July 2020 measles catch-up campaign that was paused 8 months later in March 2021?
The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, yes, in the context in which they were made.
Supplementary. Can he confirm that the measles catch-up campaign cost more than $20 million but only managed to vaccinate 3% of the target group, representing a cost of $1,900 per person?
Mr Speaker, no. The member is applying fictitious maths, which is, of course, the stock and trade for the National Party these days. The reality is that the campaign has not concluded and the campaign will continue. It is expected to continue, or planned to continue, until at least the end of June this year, and possibly will be extended.
Supplementary. Can he also confirm that nearly $2 million was spent on a public relations agency to target Māori and Pacific people, yet only 1,181 Māori were ever vaccinated, representing a PR cost of $1,500 per person?
No, Mr Speaker, the member's figures are completely wrong, and which is, again, his track record, because he repeatedly now has to withdraw figures he puts in the public arena. The reality is there was a communications campaign associated with the catch-up MMR campaign. And the House needs to recall, of course, that in 2014 the government of the day received advice that there was a gap in vaccination coverage for this area. They received advice again in 2017, and on both occasions that government did absolutely nothing about it. This government embarked on a campaign. It was planned in 2020, well before the advent of COVID, but COVID interrupted at the end of 2020 or beginning of 2021, depending on how you look at it. And like so many things, it disrupted the planned health program at that point.
Can he confirm that more was spent on PR than was spent funding the entire Māori delivery component of the campaign? And doesn't this show he actually cared more about PR spin than vaccinating Māori for measles?
Mr Speaker, no, because, and again, that member is wrong, because he acts as if the campaign is over. The campaign has not finished. The reality is this government has had to make decisions in the real world in real time, and things come along and disrupt that. This government makes hard choices and hard decisions. Unlike members on that side of the House who have just become a pack of nitpicking, niggly, nattering nabobs of negativity.
Supplementary. Isn't a $20 million measles catch-up campaign that lets $8 million of the vaccines expire, spends nearly $2 million on PR and only reaches 3% of the target audience another example why people shouldn't believe any health announcements that he makes?
Mr Speaker, no. I think what New Zealanders should be absolutely feel an absolute sense of disgrace about is that the members opposite, when they were in government, twice were notified that there was a gap in vaccination and did absolutely nothing about it. And this government did the responsible thing to put in place a program to catch up on this very important vaccination.
Mentoring.
Before I allow the supplementary, just kind of, it was a barrage of interjections. Okay, we need to.
Supplementary.
Sorry, Mr. Ducey, no. We need to dial it back, okay? Dr. Shane Huddy.
Supplementary. Does he agree that the $8 million he wasted on expired measles vaccines, or the nearly $2 million spent on PR, would have been better spent helping to clear the backlog of 50,000 women currently waiting for cancer screening mammograms?
Well, Mr Speaker, I remind that member that the backlog he talks about today as a consequence of the COVID pandemic that started in February 2021 was not known about in the early part of 2020 when the MMR vaccination catch-up campaign was arranged. That catch-up campaign would not have been necessary if the previous government had listened to the advice they got in 2014 and in 2017. But once again, we have the party on the opposition benches who is the party of anti-quality public health services compared to this government, which invests in quality public health services.
We come to question number 5, Mr Ducey. Ricardo Menendez-March.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment and asks, does she agree with Fair Future that incomes of some beneficiaries are up to $300 behind the actual cost of living for families, and that further increases are needed so that the 1st of April changes do not lock whānau into poverty?
Mr.
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr Speaker, every individual in whānau is different, with different costs, locations and incomes. While this government has lifted incomes substantially and lifted 66,500 children out of poverty, we know there are still children living in poverty and there are families doing it tough. The benefit increases that come into full effect tomorrow are forecast to lift an additional 33,000 children out of poverty on the after housing cost measure for the 2022-23 year. We cannot lift people out of poverty by just lifting incomes, which is why the government is taking a broad approach. Alongside lifting incomes, we have put more free lunches in schools, provided more free doctor's visits, started an ambitious social housing build, cut school fees and begun health and disability reforms. The half-price public transport fares coming into force tomorrow will also make a big difference. We've always said there is more to do. Our review of working for families and childcare assistance will be another step on this journey.
Supplementary. When the Minister says, quote, there's more work to do, how long will families have to wait to be able to meet their cost of living with their baseline benefit alone and free their tamariki from poverty?
Mr. Speaker, we've been very clear from the time that we've taken office that families shouldn't have to wait. That's why when we first got in that first 100 days, we invested $5.5 billion into the families package. That's why following that, we made other changes, including the repeal of two sanctions that now will see more money in the pockets of particularly women. We've lifted benefits, we've lifted abatement thresholds, we've increased working for families. There's a range of things that we have done, but there certainly is more to do.
Supplementary. Can she guarantee that all families receiving a core benefit will be at least $55 better off after the 1st of April benefit increases? And if not, how much on average will families actually get?
Mr. Speaker, the modelling that we got at the beginning when we announced the benefit increases in budget last year was that families overall with regards to the benefit increases would be better off by between $32 and $55 per week.
Supplementary. Does she stand by her statement in February 2020 that, quote, this is also the first of 4 years that income abatement thresholds will be increased in line with movement in the minimum wage, end quote, and if so, why isn't she adjusting abatement rates this year to reflect increases to the minimum wage?
And Mr. Speaker, there is a review of working for families that we are undertaking, and also I do think something that does need to be considered is the indexing of abatement thresholds to minimum wage. It's something that we haven't got to yet.
Supplementary. Does she acknowledge that when benefits are increased without subsequent adjustments to abatement levels, families are likely to experience clawback, which may result in an overall net decrease in assistance or not receiving the full amount of the benefit promised?
And Mr. Speaker, it's very fair to say that the welfare system is incredibly complicated. That's why there are other reviews that need to be undertaken, including a review of the accommodation supplement, childcare assistance, and as I said, working for families. Those interactions are very complicated and result in different outcomes for different families. We're certainly committed to looking at those interactions. That work has started, but there's more to do.
Supplementary. Has she started the work to fix the abatement rate threshold so that people can receive the full benefit increases? And if so, when does she expect to finish that work?
And Mr. Speaker, just to be clear, the abatement thresholds that the member is talking about is the amount that you can work before you start to lose benefit. And Mr. Speaker, we haven't indexed them yet. That is work that needs to be considered down the track. We certainly haven't started that.
We come to question number six in the name of Angie Warren-Clark.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Social Development and Employment, and I ask, how will New Zealanders benefit from the 1 April changes to benefits and payments that come into effect tomorrow?
Mr. Speaker,
the Honourable Carmel Sipple.
Mr. Speaker, from tomorrow, more than 1.4 million New Zealanders will see more money in their pockets, from boosts to main benefits, superannuation, working for families, the minimum wage and student allowance. But the benefits to New Zealanders go beyond just a lift in financial support. These historic lifts to main benefits in July 2021 and April 2022 will see up to 33,000 children lifted out of poverty on the after housing cost measure for the 2022-23 year, compared to the projected number for the same year without the budget 2021 increases. As a government, we are committed to improving income adequacy, and tomorrow's changes are another step in the right direction. While we have delivered the biggest lift in incomes for New Zealand's most vulnerable in decades, we know there is more to do.
Supplementary. What other initiatives come into effect on 1 April which will help New Zealanders?
Mr Speaker, in addition to main benefit increases, childcare assistance income thresholds will also begin to increase annually in line with net average wage growth. This is the first time these income thresholds have been adjusted in 12 years, when that was stopped by the previous government in 2010. Orphans' benefit and unsupported child's benefit will also increase by between 12 and 26% per week. In addition to this, this government is reducing the tax on fuel and halving costs for public transport. Initiatives which will help all New Zealanders by reducing the costs of transport for themselves and the goods and services provided by businesses.
Supplementary.
Supplementary, the Honourable Louise Upsner.
Mr Speaker, will there be fewer children growing up in benefit-dependent homes as a result of the 1 April changes? And if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, our priority is making sure that we reduce the number of children living in poverty, Mr Speaker. And so that is why the increases to benefits tomorrow, and also the increases to the family tax credit, are going to make a significant difference to a large number of New Zealanders' lives.
Supplementary.
Andrew Warren-Clark.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Will there be any more support provided to superannuitants and beneficiaries?
Mr Speaker, yes. In a month's time, superannuitants and beneficiaries will receive the winter energy payment. This payment was introduced by the government in 2018 and helps over 1 million New Zealanders every year meet the cost of heating and power during the winter months. Since we came into government in 2017, we have consistently delivered boosts to the incomes for New Zealand's most vulnerable. Tomorrow is yet another milestone on the way to supporting New Zealanders most in need.
I will come to question number 7, the name of Debbie Ngāre Wepeka joining us remotely.
Tēnā koe, Te Pika. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, does he stand by the decision to loosen protections under the COVID-19 traffic light framework when Aotearoa's COVID-19 daily mortality rate is for the first time past the daily mortality rate of the United States?
The Honourable Dr Aisha Ferial.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, yes, the changes announced last week, informed by the latest evidence from here and overseas, have been specifically designed to make life simpler and closer to normal, while retaining the things that have proven effective in reducing the spread of the virus, like face masks, testing and isolation, and capacity limits in the highest risk settings. Our response has and will continue to focus on protecting those groups who face a disproportionate effect from this virus, including Māori, Pacifica, immune compromised, and disability. I know hearing about reports of deaths can be confronting and of course reflect a loss for the affected whānau. And I would note that while deaths linked to COVID in New Zealand have sadly been rising at this stage, a comparison of death rates between two countries based on a single day is not a useful comparison given our different stages in an Omicron outbreak. New Zealand's daily death rate per million remains 5 times lower than the US at its peak in late 2020 and 4 times lower than the US's more recent Omicron peak in February. The United States has now had almost 1 million people die from COVID-19. New Zealand's total mortality per capita is still one of the lowest in the OECD.
Supplementary, Debbie Ngāre Wepeka. We're not getting any sound through the system. Wonder if we can get some technical help with that, hopefully.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you now. Debbie Ngāre Wepeka.
Is he concerned that the recent announcement to loosen restrictions sends the wrong message to the country when Māori, Pacifica, disabled and low-income whānau are still greatly at risk from COVID-19? If not, why not?
The government needs to justify any public health restrictions in terms of their efficacy, and we know that the removal of mandates or the use of vaccine passes at a time when there is high levels of immunity does not further increase the public health risk. We're also advised that there is minimal additional public health risk from the removal of gathering limits at the red setting. People who face high risk of illness from COVID can be reassured that we continue public health measures where they make an important difference. This includes the use, the recommended use of masks, the isolation of cases and contacts, the use of testing to identify cases, and the provision of care in the community and in hospitals to ensure that the impact of COVID is minimised.
What has been done, if anything, to strengthen support and resourcing for Māori Pacifica, disabled and low-income whānau, who are the most at risk when the worsening COVID-19 mortality rate, and ensure this support continues into winter?
Indeed, a large amount of work across our response is underway in partnership with those providers. So if we take, take any aspect of the COVID response. For example, ongoing efforts to roll out boosters are underway with over 70 Māori providers. Efforts to make sure that rapid antigen tests are provided to Māori and Pacifica whānau are vast. There are over 1,000 Māori organisations providing rapid antigen tests. There is an integrated welfare response between Māori providers and the Ministry of Social Development that ensures that food is provided to whānau who need it while they're isolating, and that whānau's needs are collectively are managed in a holistic way. And indeed, these efforts will be sustained through winter should another peak arise.
Point of order. I understand the answer given. However, my question was, what has been done to strengthen the support? I didn't ask for a list of what's currently being done.
Yeah, the question was addressed. We come to question number 8 in the name of Paul Eagle.
Tēnā koe te mangai o te whare. My question is to the Minister COVID-19, the Minister of Health. What medicines has the government recently secured access to that support New Zealanders against COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker. The Honourable Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, while vaccinations and booster shots remain the best defence against COVID-19, having more medicines available is an important step in helping prevent vulnerable people from becoming unwell and needing further treatment. Today I announced that New Zealand has added 60,000 courses of Paxlovid, an oral medicine, for this year that will be available to New Zealanders with a valid prescription. We've also secured access to New Zealand's first pre-exposure prophylactic treatment for COVID-19, Evusheld. This treatment provides an option for those who cannot have vaccines.
Supplementary. How do these medicines support New Zealanders against COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, Paxlovid is a five-day course of tablets that needs to be taken within 5 days of first developing symptoms of COVID-19. Access to Paxlovid will be tight to make sure it gets to the people who need it most. It will be prescribed by doctors, with factors such as age, disability and being immunocompromised taken into account. On Evusheld, this is a pre-exposure prophylactic treatment, as I said, and that can actually stop people developing COVID-19. Evusheld allows antibodies that provide protection against COVID-19 to be given directly to a patient and does not require a patient's immune system to create these antibodies. If approved by MedSafe, access criteria to Evusheld will be published by Pharmac.
Supplementary. When will these drugs be available amongst the broader range of COVID-19 therapeutics New Zealand has access to?
Mr. Speaker, the first shipment of Paxlovid has arrived in New Zealand ahead of schedule and will start being offered to those most at risk from next week. The benefit of this medicine is that by protecting people from getting seriously ill, it will prevent the health system also from being overwhelmed. Regarding Evusheld, this is currently going through MedSafe approval, and we expect New Zealanders who meet the criteria for it could receive treatment with it from about middle of this year.
Question number 9 in the name of the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Workplace Relations and Safety. How will fair pay agreements help New Zealand businesses and workers to meet the challenges and opportunities presented in a rapidly changing world of work? And has he taken on board advice, if any, during the development of the fair pay agreement framework?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the member for the opportunity to speak about how the fair pay agreement system will help New Zealand workers to combat the challenges and embrace the opportunities presented in the rapidly changing world of work. I note that fair pay agreements were an important manifesto commitment of the Labor Party at the last election. We've worked since then on taking on board the advice of officials, noting that our view is always that we should follow through on the commitments that we make. In respect of the first part of the member's question, I draw his attention to a very useful quote from the forward of the Fair Pay Agreements Working Group from the Right Honourable Jim Bolger, who said, quote, "It is vitally important that New Zealand tackle significant issues which are likely to affect other people's working lives in the coming years. I believe that a focus on lifting productivity and preparing New Zealanders with the skills to thrive in the future of work is vitally important if we are to succeed as a nation. Fair pay agreements could be a useful tool to address these important challenges." Mr. Speaker, that's because fair pay agreements are about shifting the focus from competition based on low wages to competition based on the quality of products and services, innovation, research and developments, and the other things that actually build prosperity and productivity. I would, however, draw the member's attention to one other quote from the Right Honourable Jim Bolger,
Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
How will fair pay agreements, which could impose mandatory nationwide terms and conditions on certain industries and occupations, make Kiwi businesses more agile?
Mr. Speaker, I draw the member's attention to the fact that we do have mandatory conditions across the labour market at the moment. Those are things such as the minimum wage, such as minimum annual leave and minimum sick leave. They provide a basic floor for workers' terms and conditions, and actually most decent employers believe that that's a good thing. One of the important things about fair pay agreements is that in the establishment of a floor, they support decent employers who want to provide good pay and conditions from being undercut, and those employers can therefore compete on the basis of those things that will actually drive greater productivity. That's what we've seen in many other jurisdictions overseas.
With regard to the advice from officials on direct costs of fair pay agreements in the range of $160 to $620 million a year, does he accept that some of those costs will be passed on to consumers, adding to the cost of living crisis that Kiwi families are facing every day?
Mr. Speaker, there is a lot of similarity between the member's question and a comment made by the EMA yesterday, which noted that the purpose of fair pay agreements are to increase the wages of workers. And the only answer that I can give to that is yes. On this side of the House, we believe that's a good thing. And I'd ask the member to reflect on the fact that at a time in which his side of the House is talking a lot about the cost of living, they seem implacably opposed to any measure that actually improves the wages of our lowest paid workers.
Kieran McNaughton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What reports has he seen about other models like the fair paid agreement system around the world?
Mr. Speaker, I have seen reports from a range of different sources about, for example, Australia's modern award system. Australia, of course, has had a higher rate of labour productivity than New Zealand in the period during which it has a sector-based bargaining system, similar to fair pay agreements, as has Singapore and as had Germany, one of the most successful innovating export economies in the world.
Did it worry him that Treasury advised in relation to fair pay agreements that, quote, there has been minimal identification of empirical evidence for the problem or for the policy response, end quote? And did he think the Treasury officials were essentially saying that his bill is driven by ideology rather than any evidence?
Mr. Speaker, from time to time I have disagreed with the advice that has been provided by the Treasury. What I do agree with is the advice and views that I receive, for example, from real Kiwi workers, people like the cleaners who come into our offices here at Parliament every night, who note that in order to try and live a decent life and pay the bills, they often have to string 2 to 3 different jobs together. That is a legacy of the deregulation of the labour market that occurred in the late 1990s. I know that they were halcyon days for the member and those people that he idolises, but on this side of the House and across most of New Zealand, we've moved on and we want a decent labour market to support those workers.
Was the only advice that he listened to the advice that he got from his union official friends and former union official workers?
Mr Speaker, now I've heard advice from a range of people, as we've just heard from the Right Honourable Jim Bolger and the working group that was convened several years ago. And I've also heard advice, for example, from the OECD, who notes that New Zealand is one of the few countries in the developed world without a sector-based bargaining system, and that the most effective labour markets do tend to have a mix of individual, firm enterprise-based and sector-based collective bargaining.
Kieran McInaughty.
Has the Minister seen any other quotes from the Right Honourable Jim Bolger? And if so, what did it say?
Mr Speaker.
Order. You need to make the question relevant to the primary question, not to the answer, yes, which you did not. So you want to have a...
Point of order?
Point of order.
The answer to the previous question directly referred to statements by Jim Bolger.
Yeah, well, you can't just have endless supply of... Of quotes. They have to be relevant to the supplementary.
Thank you. Has the Minister seen any other comments from the Right Honourable Jim Bolger in relation to fair pay agreements? If so, what did they say?
The Honourable Michael Wood.
Mr Speaker, yes, I've seen a range of comments that the Right Honourable Jim Bolger made. He did an excellent job in terms of leading that working group, which included representatives from unions and from employers on it. He put forward some of the arguments for a sector-based bargaining system. He did, however, also note that unfortunately there will always be some people, quote, who always try to screw the worker, end quote, Mr Goldsmith.
We come to question number 10 in the name of Ginny Anderson.
Tēnā koe e te māngai. My question is to the Minister for Police. What reports has she seen regarding diversity in the New Zealand police workforce?
The Honourable Portal Williams.
Tēnā koe te māngai, te whare. I've seen a report that shows diversity amongst frontline New Zealand police staff is increasing at a rate never seen before. Since we've come to office in 2017, there has been a record number of graduates from Police College who have been women, Māori and Pacifica. These reports show that in time, nearly 4 out of every 10 graduates from Police College have been women, with Māori, Pacifica and Asian recruits making up 37% of all new police since 2017. Police recognise the value of different perspectives and experiences bring to making our community safer. Our recent graduates bring with them an invaluable range of skills, backgrounds and experiences that will serve our communities for decades to come.
Supplementary. What do upcoming police graduation wings mean for growing diversity in police?
Mr Speaker, tomorrow I am attending the graduation of Wing 352 at the Royal New Zealand Police College, which is a significant milestone for police and for this government as it marks the graduation of our 3,000th recruit since October 2017. Each individual police graduation has its own story to tell about the growing diversity in police. And Wing 355, set to graduate later this year, is made up of 75 recruits, of which 31 are Māori and 23 are Wahine Māori. Since we began our drive to grow the police workforce, we have seen the number of Wahine Māori police officers grow by 2/3. The graduation of this Wahine Māori wing will be a historic milestone for police and for New Zealand.
What does the growing diversity of our police workforce mean for our regions?
Mr Speaker, growing the diversity of our frontline police means that they are more likely to represent the communities in which they serve. Since 2017, we have grown the police footprint across the country. In Northland, 88 additional cops. In Waikato, 97 more cops. And in Canterbury, 99 more cops. This government will continue to support our police to do their job while also growing the diversity of the workforce so that they can represent the people they protect.
Melissa Lee.
Thank you,
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Why is the Minister confident that the New Zealand police workforce has acceptable diversity when the leading multicultural organisations in Nelson, Tasman wrote to the police commissioner protesting the absence of an ethnic liaison officer, and I quote, "Funding for an ELO was evidently allocated but not utilised by the regional command," unquote. Where is the money gone?
Mr. Speaker, while I can't speak to the allocation of funding, that is a matter for the police. What I can speak to is the increasing diversity, including Asian police officers in New Zealand. And if I just go back to the answer that I gave, we are increasing Māori, Pacifica and Asian recruits up to 37% of all new police since 2017.
Point of order, Melissa Lee.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table a status report from the Ministry of Ethnic Communities that I received via OIA detailing this particular issue.
Leave is sought for that purpose. Is there any objection? There is none. May be tabled. We come to question number 11 in the name of Simon O'Connor.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections and asks, is he satisfied New Zealanders are getting value for money from the prison system, and if so, why?
The Honourable Calvin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, yes, because the trajectory the former National Government had the prison system on would have seen New Zealand having to build multi-billion dollar American-style mega prisons every couple of years, both a moral and a fiscal failure.
How is it acceptable that total prisoner costs have increased by over $130 million since 2018, and yet the number of prisoners accessing rehabilitation has dropped sharply?
Well, Mr. Speaker, first of all, the fixed costs of running a prison don't change. But also, and this might take a bit of time, Mr. Speaker, I'm going to run through some of the investment that Corrections has made in what they do. First of all, the High Impact Innovation Program, that's just under $15 million. Management of people of extreme risk, that's over $6.5 million. The Māori Pathways, that's $10 million.
No, I don't think we need a whole list of...
Well, Mr. Speaker, just the final point then is that dividing the total cost of by the lowest prison numbers since 2008 gives a higher average per prisoner. Now, that is simple Year 8 maths.
Order. Questions asked in silence. Thank you.
Seeing the Minister's keen to quote maths, if the cost remained the same to manage a prison, then ipso facto would not the same cost remain stable rather than going up $130 million, you know, mathematics.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, can I please read through the whole list? Because there are hundreds of millions of dollars of investment, such as in Māori Pathways, such as in increasing access to mental health and addiction, over $125 million. The Waikerea prison rebuild operating costs come to well over $200 million. Mr. Speaker, this government has invested in corrections and invested in keeping New Zealanders safe.
Point of order of the Honourable Michael Waters.
As the Minister appeared to be quoting verbatim from what sounded like an official document, may we have that document table, please?
I can see it. It's handwritten.
I will ask the Minister, was that an official document that you're quoting from? Order, Simon O'Connor, supplementary.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Appreciating that long list of initiatives, how does he then respond to reports about those which says there's only been a modest reduction because of them in re-imprisonment and re-sentencing rates? In fact, most results of these don't even reach statistical significance.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, the fact is that they are better than the results that the previous National Government was achieving.
That's right.
Again, how can he actually say that when that quote's from his own annual report, again suggesting that there's only been modest reductions in re-imprisonment and the results that he has achieved basically of statistical insignificance.
Well, Mr. Speaker, again, they are better than the results that the previous national government was achieving, where they actually went up.
We come to question number 12 in the name of Tangi Utikere.
Tēnā koe, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister for COVID-19 Response. How is the government ensuring remote communities can readily access rapid antigen tests?
The Honourable...
Point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Dr. Davis.
Sorry, there was just something going on with the sound system that I didn't quite catch. I just wonder whether the member could repeat the question.
I beg your pardon?
Apologies. Mr. Speaker, it's probably fine. Thank you.
The Honourable Aisha, Dr. Aisha Vera.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, the government has launched an additional targeted rural service of rapid antigen tests for those who live in remote rural areas. Now that the purpose of testing has shifted away from finding every case, RATs provide intelligence on the spread and size of the outbreak, alert people to the support available to them, and help bring a sense of normality to people's lives. More than 95% of New Zealanders are within a 20-minute drive of a RAT access point, but we need to make sure that the 250,000 who live remotely are also able to access testing easily.
Tree, how will the new service work?
DHBs already have initiatives underway to reach their rural communities. The service launched this week aims to improve connections between households and those initiatives. And if there's no existing initiative in your area, we will courier RATs directly to your home. The service can be accessed via the assisted channel on 0800 222 478 or through the RAT Requester website.
To the Minister, what are some of those existing initiatives by DHBs?
The DHBs are using a number of unconventional methods to reach their communities, Mr. Speaker. Whanganui DHB, for example, is distributing on average 12,000 tests per day. They are using jet boats, flying foxes, and they're even exploring the option of delivering them via horseback to make sure that no one is left behind. The West Coast DHB's COVID-19 vaccination team, who travel to remote areas, have a stock of rats on board ready for distribution.
Point of order, Andrew Warren Clark.
My apologies, Mr. Speaker. I actually can't hear the answer. I would appreciate being able to hear it.
I must say it has been quite rowdy this afternoon. So, if Dr. Verrill wishes to continue her answer.
The West Coast DHB's COVID-19 vaccination team who travel to remote areas have a stock of rapid antigen tests on board ready for distribution. And South Canterbury has initiated proactive distribution of rats to the High Country stations in their region. I want to thank all the DHBs, Māori providers and rapid antigen test distributors for their work assisting rural communities.
That concludes oral questions.